Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's next program takes place tomorrow night at the Performing Arts Center, and this year, the symphony has been assigning a color as the title for each concert. Well, the color red features three saucy American works: Charles Ives Symphony No. 1, the oldest of the bunch. Crossover violin sensation Mark O'Connor is the featured soloist in his very own double concerto with fellow soloist Kelly Hall Tompkins. And Michael Dougherty's speedy Route 66 opens the program. My guest today is the conductor for tomorrow night's concert, Timothy Myers, the artistic director of the North Carolina Opera Company. Myers is a successful young American conductor that has straddled the worlds of opera as well as symphonic music. He just finished a three-year term as principal guest conductor of Opera Africa in Johannesburg. He's been engaged as an assistant or associate positions with the New York Philharmonic, the New York City Opera, London BBC Symphony, and was guest conductor and artistic advisor of the Palm Beach Symphony as well. He recently made his debut this past summer at Chautauqua Symphony, and in 2014, he'll conduct two major opera world premieres, Ricky Ian Gordon's A Coffin in Egypt at the Houston Grand Opera, which will feature the return of Frederica von Stade, who's coming out of retirement, Crozier's With Blood with Ink at Fort Worth Opera. He'll also be conducting a world premiere of John Sipko's All Souls at the Duke Performances in North Carolina with New Music Raleigh. Timothy Myers leads the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Timothy Myers, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and welcome back to the area. You're from this area, Richard.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great to be here. I am. I'm originally from central Kansas, from a small town called Great Bend.
Mm-hmm. In this program you're conducting for the Tulsa Symphony, they've given color titles in red. Red seems to be flashy music, and there is a bit of flashy music in this particular program.
There is. There's some flash and particularly some really jazzy kind of stuff, and jazzy being a broader term. In the Michael Dougherty Route 66 piece that we're opening the program with, it's got a lot of sort of jazz-based things. It's very popular-influenced music. Then, of course, Mark O'Connor's double violin concerto is all based on bluegrass and blues and jazz and things like this. So there's a lot of upbeat and really great listenable music in this program.
Now, is this the sort of music you really love to conduct? Is this? I know you did some Dougherty in some recent trips abroad.
Yeah, I do. As a young American conductor, of course, it's something that I can really relate to. And especially being from the Midwest and just really true Americana rings with me. And so I really enjoy doing this kind of music. And as you mentioned, for example, I did another Dougherty piece in Malaysia recently. And to see how well it was accepted and how people can relate to it is really, really fascinating. So I love doing this stuff just as much as I love doing the core European repertoire, because there's something about it that, of course, speaks to me as a regular American.
Now, tell us a little bit about this piece, Route 66. It sort of reminds me in some ways of John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine, except there's lots of starts and stops, and it's like these just sort of abrupt turns. It's almost like a road trip in many ways, but a 6-minute road trip.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's was kind of his intent, was to be able to express a lot of different things in a short period of time. You're right, it's similar to the Adams in that there's sort of a percussion ostinato going on most of the time that kind of keeps the pulse. And it's interesting to rehearse this kind of piece with an orchestra, because it's about them sort of locking with the rhythm section more than you as the conductor and mm-hmm. really finding where that is. But yeah, he's very good at sort of, you know, he's compact. And so he's very good at outlining these melodies and sort of getting the music going, you know, in a great direction very fast. And then he can sort of turn these corners and change the colors or change the tempo a little bit or change the texture to kind of start expressing other things. So I think for a 6-minute piece, it's upbeat and it's a great opener, but really fascinating what he's able to accomplish in that short amount of time for the audience.
And usually when you think of a 6-minute piece, you think of maybe a little slow section and then fast, you know, like an overture of some sort.
Right.
But this is like it's really changing a lot. It's like you're really going around corners quite fast and subjects are changing almost completely except the little motive that keeps coming back.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's interesting. It's not something like you would think, like a Verdi sort of overture or something, you know, Forza. It's completely different. I would say it's more like a little character piece, or as the name would say, I mean, it's sort of a little triptych kind mm-hmm. of thing. You know, I remember as a kid, when we'd go on vacation, my dad would go to the AAA office and they would give you the triptych of, you know, the roads that they recommended you take and where to stay and
things to do alongside the road.
Exactly. I think this piece is just a little miniature version of that.
All right. Well, let's hear a little music of Michael Dougherty. He's a Route 66, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday night. That's music of Michael Dougherty from Route 66, one of three works to be conducted by my guest today, Timothy Myers, the artistic director of the North Carolina Opera Company, a young American conductor who has already gone all around the world. You had a stint in Africa conducting opera there. You've got two world premieres coming up next year, including one with Houston Grand Opera.
Right.
So this is interesting. You do seem to balance the world of opera and symphonic music, which a lot of times you can either be an opera conductor or you be a symphony conductor, and you seem to be doing both.
Right. It's interesting. It's not been easy as a young American conductor. In Europe, that's sort of the model, is that you are proficient in both genres. In America, there's not quite the structure that encourages or allows that, and a lot of people really try and pigeonhole you and say, oh, he's just an opera guy, he's just a symphonic guy. But I really, once I became interested in conducting and really started pursuing it, I made a determination that I wanted to do both equally well, because I think they serve each other well. They inform the other very well. So it's taken some convincing, for people to believe that I can do a commanding performance of Beethoven 7 and then a really great performance of La Traviata the next night.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you feel that they do inform each other? Because, you know, with opera, you're dealing with all sorts of issues extraneous to the music. Am I balancing with the singers?
Yeah.
Is what I'm doing coordinating with what's happening on the stage, as opposed to a pure music experience like in the symphonic repertoire?
Well, it's interesting. When I became interested in conducting, I started, of course, reading the memoirs of Scholti and Carrion and all.
And they all started in opera houses.
They all did. And that's one thing that I realized. I thought, oh, wow, there's one common strain, two common strains. The first one is that they all started in the opera house. The second one is that they were all primarily concerned about being a great musician first before they started conducting. So I thought, well, I'm American, but I can fashion this kind of path, which is really what I did. And it's fascinating. I think with opera, of course, as you say, it's just on a different scale. You're dealing with the chorus, with the orchestra, with soloists. You're dealing with distance between you and certain musicians that is not happening on a symphonic stage. But it's interesting, for example, Kleiber was very clear when he was talking about this, once he wrote a letter to a young conductor for some encouragement and said, do opera because that's where you learn the trade. That's where you learn the craft, the technique. Because you can imagine, I mean, when I conduct Aida and I've got 75 people
in the orchestra. You have to be absolutely clear.
And, you know, 100 people on stage, you know, there's no error, room for error.
Or ambiguity in what you're trying to convey.
Exactly. And so not only do you have to keep the forces together, but on top of that, you have to be able to conduct an emotional, connected, convincing performance. So it's not just being a traffic cop. And so it's a great joy for me than when I also just walk onto a stage with a symphony orchestra and everybody's there and there are no sightline problems and, you know, they're not in this deep hole and we can just really focus on just finer points of music making down to the tiniest details and take the time to do that. But I also find that when I'm conducting a symphonic orchestra, I think I approach things with a sense of drama and a sense of line that come from working with that, singers and in the vocal. Operatic repertoire. Yeah. So for me, like strings and winds, I'm always talking about singing tone and legato and concepts like this, as well as really having specific ideas in my mind about what character do I want in the music there and how do I achieve that? Which are decisions that you have to make. You know, in opera, the text describes that and gives you context of how to make the music most of the time. In the symphonic world, it's very different. So you have to have an imagination to bring it to life so it's not just sort of a pedantic performance.
You know, the other part of what you were talking about using that European model is that in the European opera houses, a conductor might conduct 15 operas a year,
right.
90 to 100 to 150 performances.
Right.
Here in the United States, as an American opera conductor, it's maybe three performances a year,
right.
three shows, four shows, five shows, maybe even less, two right. shows of that. And you don't have that training ground part of a mm-hmm. European opera house.
Yeah, you don't. And so, again, it's one of those things that I sort of had to create for myself. And so, boy, especially when I was just starting out, I took everything everywhere. And so I did my first Rigoletto in a tiny house with, I think, 23 people in the orchestra or something. And I had to do a lot of what I refer to as defensive conducting, because you're not sure what's going to go wrong next. But I tell you, what I learned in those situations was that if you can make music in that situation, then when you get in front of a good orchestra, you're going to be great with them. When you get in front of a great orchestra, it's spectacular. So I'm grateful that I had those opportunities to learn the repertoire that way and learn my skill set that way, because I think now I'm just a more confident musician.
My guest today is Timothy Myers, the artistic director of the North Carolina Opera Company and guest conductor for Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's concert titled Red, which will feature Michael Dougherty's Route 66, Mark O'Connor's double violin concerto mm-hmm. with the composer as one of the soloists.
Yeah.
That's got to be a great thing. I mean, how often do you get to work with the soloist who actually wrote the piece? That doesn't happen too much in the opera world.
Right.
Maybe you might work with a living composer, but more often not.
It's a treat. I've never done it where the composer was also the soloist. Of course, I've done, premieres and things or works by living composers, and you have the privilege of having them there with you, which is really a privilege because you can just have a musical dialogue going with them the whole time and really dig into their brain and how they feel about things. With them as a soloist, it's also a really interesting thing. And Mark, of course, as you know, is an incredibly diverse musician.
Was the Nashville Most Valuable Player for many years.
Yeah.
Just the fiddle player that people would go to in Nashville. Of course, he's like Yo-Yo Ma and Edgar Meyer and the
right.
rest. These sort of genre-busting musicians that sort of do everything.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really fascinating because, as you mentioned, this trio CD he did with Yo-Yo and Edgar Meyer, that really caught on, and I think that really started saying a lot when musicians of that caliber were opening the doors and saying, we get out there into the fringe of our genre and even completely into other genres. And I really, really admire that a lot. And I've tried to do that a lot in my career as well and be open, because my desire as a musician is to illustrate that nothing is really that different. There's no barrier between what you listen to on a daily basis or may listen to on a daily basis and what you might hear in the concert hall. It's all music. There's some good. There's some bad.
Two kinds of music, good
right.
and bad.
Duke Ellington. Coltrane?
Duke Ellington.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
And so I really love collaborating with people like Mark who have that same spirit, because I think it leads to a real openness in communication with the audience. And that's obviously, for me, the most important thing.
Tell us a little about this piece. Did you know it prior to preparing for this concert?
I didn't. It's a kind of standard concerto format, about 30 minutes, three movements. And I think you'll find it fascinating. Just, it's music that you'll instantly relate to. And it's not a violin concerto, it's a fiddle concerto. we know there's kind of a difference, and I mean, even Mark, if we were sitting here, would say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really got a lot of great interplay between the two soloists, and the way that it develops musically is really fascinating. The middle movement is a little bit slower, a little bluesier kind of feeling, maybe in a slightly smoky, hazy room kind of thing. And then this great culmination with it's a large orchestra, and so the climaxes are really, really thrilling. But at the same time, you've got large sections, you know, these cadenzas with just the two soloists playing and interacting. There's, you know, some improvisation involved, and so it's great because you go from these really intimate musical moments to where you've got a massive orchestra. Really, I think even at one point in the score, he marks things like "swing it really hard." So you know, it's really exciting when you hear an orchestra doing that.
And all three movements are sort of some variation of swing. There's a blues movement, I guess. There's a swing movement, and then a Dixieland,
right? Yeah. The last one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's hear the opening of the final movement. This is Mark O'Connor playing his own double violin concerto, and this recording with Nadja Salerno-Sonnenberg. But here's the opening of the final movement. Music by Mark O'Connor, who will be with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, and my guest today, conductor Timothy Myers, playing his double violin concerto. That was the opening of the final movement. The other work on the concert is Charles Ives Symphony No. 1. And when people hear the name Charles Ives, they think of things like the 4th of July with the, you know, the two bands marching through each other, and it's cacophony. And also they think of a lot of his stringent later movement. Now, this is the Symphony No. 1.
Right.
Very different piece.
It's a very, very different piece, and I'm glad we're talking about it because, as you say, when we say the name Charles Ives, people start thinking of kind of crunchy music and polytonality and polyrhythms, like some of these things that not everyone finds approachable. Let's say it that way.
And there's also an intellectual approach to his later music, too, which is almost supersedes some of the musical qualities of it in many ways.
Right, exactly. But this is a fascinating piece. Charles Ives, in general, was a really fascinating man.
An insurance executive
that started essentially the format, the model now that turned into like a planned giving, estate giving. But he wrote this first symphony when he was in his last year at Yale. And it's a little unclear, but it seems like not the whole thing was his final project for graduation, but maybe three of the movements. So it's interesting because he had been really, at that time, he grew up with a father who was a musician and was the town band director and really encouraged him to explore things musically. He was a very good organist, Charles was. But he had been really at Yale ensconced thoroughly in the Western European, well, and Eastern European, but just the European tradition. And so being steeped in that and really with a teacher who disciplined him to write in that style, to learn that craft, if I were to put this on, you might just as well think it was Dvorak than Ives. So it's very fascinating to look at kind of what his musical influences were. You'll hear Tchaikovsky in it. You'll hear Dvorak. You'll hear, there are some moments to me that sound a whole lot like Sibelius. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to look at this and then to look at where he went from there. But this is very, very reminiscent of something like the New World Symphony.
Now, when you hear something like this, you hear it's obviously Western European influenced. Do you hear that sort of Americana struggling to get out, or little moments American music, which he would be so much a part of creating.
I think what you do hear, I don't think you hear that directly in the use of harmony or things like maybe you would with Gershwin.
No.
Where you do hear it is in his fascination with melodic material that has a folk-like quality. For example, the second movement begins with an English horn solo, much like Dvorak's New World. But you know, he was very fascinated, as we know, from really early on at his musical experiences, hymn tunes that he heard or that he heard the city band playing or all of these kind of things. And so you hear in this symphony a lot of usage like that, just really great snippets of melody that he develops and then brings them back around and kind of tucks them all in together, you know, at the end in a pretty fascinating way.
I always think of it as a quintessential New England composer. I mean, those hymn tunes were just, it's just as American as the white Congregationalist church.
Absolutely.
You know, on the hill.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it'll be an interesting thing for people to hear something from a composer that, you know, we more know his later works and kind of have an expectation of what those are, but to see where he started. And where he, as they say, you need to learn the rules before you can break them. and so this is why we all, in music school, we all learned counterpoint and, you know, writing Bach chorales and things like this. You know, this is sort of similar. This is Ives' first foray into a major symphonic form. And then, you know, that he developed a lot.
And yet it's still performed today. So there must be something more than just the culmination of student work.
Right. It's interesting because you hear places where that student quality comes out a little bit, or maybe
a little clunky at times,
slightly clunky, or maybe there's just where it might overstay its welcome for a couple of seconds. Like maybe that 8 bars didn't need to be repeated.
Mm-hmm.
So you find things like that. And it's interesting as I was learning the work, you know, of course, I was listening to some various recordings. I remember hearing recordings that had a lot of cuts in the music. And I thought, well, you can sort of cut it and try and modify it and trim it and make it better. But then that's really not allowing his sort of youthful exuberance to come out, right? And so so I'm, you know, anxious to just present and say, here's who he was. Here was the guy at this age and finishing college.
And what do you think of that process of actually pruning? I mean, you know, there's one thing, like if you, in a Beethoven symphony, maybe not taking a repeat. And that's, even that's somewhat controversial.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing because it can go so deep. There in the Ives, there is one repeat that I won't take. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. In Beethoven 7, do you take that, you know, the repeat? That's a question. And some people are really on one side of the fence and that, you know, it has to be played. I tend to be on the other side. I try and find a balance of respecting what the composer wrote, but also realizing that that form doesn't have the same impact on people now as it did, right, for a standard listener. And so sometimes the best thing I can do is to streamline it a little bit so that it has a great dramatic energy and tension that's sustaining throughout the work that keeps the listener constantly engaged, as opposed to repeating a large section simply because that was formally the way it was done by a composer at that point in time.
Right, and really it's with Beethoven where you actually begin to hear the symphony complete through. I mean, before, symphonies were, you played a movement, you played a quartet,
right,
then you played another movement of the symphony a little later. It wasn't the concert situation that we're used to now.
Exactly.
But when you have a composer like Ives, though, that was certainly written to be heard the way he was thinking at the time when he wrote it.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It's an interesting question because, as you know, then you get into all sorts of other editing and things. As, you know, I mean, a lot for a long time, and still today, a lot of people heavily edit Beethoven symphonies, Schumann especially.
Yes.
Especially, like, I remember when I first conducted Schumann's Third Symphony, my mentor, Lauren Mazel, lent me his score, and there were large parts of it that were just reorchestrated, you know, changing horn lines and doubling this melody and changing that. And I think that's not as in vogue now as it was. But it's interesting to see that process of how people are growing with these masterpieces that we've had with us, and how now the period performance thing that comes into play. And you hear John Elliott Gardner and his orchestra play Beethoven, and it's an amazing experience, but completely different from how American orchestras have been playing it for the last 80 years.
Right.
So it's fascinating to sort of take a survey of how ideas about music, however old it is, are still changing and evolving. And I think that speaks really highly of the art form.
Yeah, there's a reason why we're still arguing over it.
That's right.
200
yeah.
years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. My guest today is Timothy Myers, Artistic Director of the North Carolina Opera Company and guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's concert titled Red this Saturday night at 7:30, featuring works by Doherty, Mark O'Connor, and Charles Ives. We mentioned it earlier, you have a couple of big premieres coming up next year. You're doing a premiere of a new opera, Ricky Ian Gordon's Coffin in Egypt. How did this come about?
Well, this came about, it's at Houston Grand Opera, which is one of the larger companies in the United States, yes. and a wonderful opera house. And I had been doing a little work with them and in this series of chamber opera premieres that they had been doing. And that was how my relationship started with the company. And then when this project came up, it just seemed to be a great fit. And they, you know, entrusted me with it. It'll be a wonderful piece. It's the legendary mezzo-soprano Friederike von Stade is coming out of retirement to sing the principal role. So I'm thrilled. And, of course, Ricky Ian Gordon, you know, is sort of becoming now a quintessential American composer of, you know, of vocal music.
You also have a couple of premieres, too, another one with Fort Worth Opera, and then another one in North Carolina with New Music Raleigh.
Yeah, Duke Performances, yeah. So next season, I'll have three significant world premieres, which is exciting. I love conducting the standard core repertoire on a week-to-week basis, but it's really great to do things like this, too. For example, the premiere in Houston is a year and a half away, or a little less than that now, but I was meeting with Ricky in December and hearing what he had already written and kind of getting a feel of the shape of the piece and the libretto and et cetera, et cetera. So it's fascinating to be able to be involved at that level in the creation of something and knowing that I will be the first conductor to put his hands on it and to have that, you know, influence how it's shaped and how it paces. I love working on both sides of the coin in this way. It's really fascinating to me as a musician.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing better than being with a composer when he's composing a work and also having that composer's guidance as you're interpreting what he's put on paper.
And sometimes it can be very helpful for them as well, because there are certainly times where a composer has an idea and may put it on paper in a certain way. But as a conductor, you can say, I get what you're going for. Try this. I think you'll find it to be more effective and still fulfill your goal. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating synergy when you work with a composer, especially when you get along really well. It helps if you can kind of, you know, the musical minds coming together is a great thing.
And we look forward to some minds coming together with Mark O'Connor this weekend. And we wish you great success with the program.
Great.
Timothy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Timothy Myers is the Artistic Director of the North Carolina Opera Company and guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's program titled Red, featuring works by Doherty, O'Connor, and Charles Ives Symphony No. 1, tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For ticket information, call the PAC box office at 918-596-7111 or visit tulsasymphony.org. We're going to leave you with a little music by Charles Ives. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.